You might have to start eating some gumbo. A bust among all busts. It's just me and the turkeys and the geese out there. That's a nightmare. Buck fans will have every right to say, what the heck is going on over there at One Buck Place?
I always go against the grain.
All right, it is Happy Schedule Week on the Ira Kaufman Podcast, and the star of the show is the king of Pasco County, the Baron of Big Storm Beer, the Sage of Tampa Bay Sports, Uncle Ira, Mr. Ira Kaufman. Ira, we have so much to get to today, so much happening. The season never ends at JoeBucksFan.com. But how are you, Ira? Is your mask good? How you doing?
Evie, the beaches are open. One Buck Place remains closed. Baby steps, guys, baby steps. You know what? The last couple of days, it's kind of somber. As I tweeted out on Sunday, it was the four-year anniversary of the shuttering of the Tampa Tribune. I'm the only guy that remembers this. You know, I don't forget. May 3rd, 2016, a day that will live in infamy, gentlemen. 200 people tossed out on the street, including me, Joey Johnston, Martin. Fennelly got picked up, but a bunch of talented sports writers. Roy Cummings, of course, Eric Erlandson. Very, very tough day.
So, Ira, I just want to correct the record there on the Tampa Tribune. Now, 4 years ago, the Tampa Bay Times bought the property, and they made the horrible decision to fire you and release all these other people. Fire, release, whatever you want to call it. They kept some, as you noted. But what a terrible decision by that organization, and look what it did for them.
It was their call. They took two guys from the sports department, Martin and Roger Mooney, two very good journalists. Both are no longer writing about sports in the Tampa. That's a loss for the community, Lee. Martin, at his best, I don't think anybody could touch him. The guy was had tremendous breadth of knowledge, loved hockey, baseball, football. It was a horrible day. I mean, May 3rd, 2016, Lee, they had a meeting downtown. I didn't go. And then when I called the sports editor at 3:05, the meeting was at 3, and I said, what's going on? And she said, we're out of business, just like that. We've printed our last edition. And, Lee, what made it even worse, I mean, it's bad enough. We were not allowed to put out a final edition. I know that doesn't sound like much for our listeners and our readers. Big deal. It is a big deal, Lee. It is a big deal. After 123 years of publication, you'd like to say goodbye on your own terms. But I think the Times was worried, that we'd take some pot shots at them in the process. I don't think we would have. I think, and they had final edit anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Lee, we just thought that was piling on. And even if the meeting happened at 3 o'clock, we would have been able to put out a final paper. We would have got it done. You know, it would have been a little bit easier to take. I still haven't gotten over it. I mean, how can you? I remember the next day, Joey Johnston and I went back into the building to clean out our desks, take our mementos and our pictures and whatever. And we walked out. We each had a box in our hands. And Rick Mayer, guys, was an editor. And he was already standing on the street. And he took a picture of me and Joey with our boxes. I wish I still had that picture. And you can imagine the crestfallen look in our eyes. Howard Altman was out there wandering around, the great military writer who covered McGill like nobody's business. And he was hired by the Times. And now he's working for the Military Times up in D.C. Steve, I wouldn't wish a day like that on my worst enemy.
Just a sign of the times. But I still like to put it out there that the Tampa Bay Times had a chance to keep the great Sage of Tampa Bay sports, and they passed.
You're bummed out that you and your colleagues never could put out a final edition. For people who may not understand why that's important, a newspaper, and you know, I've looked for newspapers too, a newspaper, it's part of your blood, part of your life. You sure as heck aren't doing it to be rewarded financially.
Right.
It's sort of like a labor of love that your name's on it. Every day your name's on it. I mean, it's like if a guy designed a Ford pickup and was sold by Bill Curry Ford, and that guy's name was on the dashboard. It's like a piece of you and something you're proud of. And for a paper to be bought out, I shouldn't say go under, but be bought out, shuttered, that's sort of like, you know, someone calling you up and say, hey, your brother, your dad, whomever, he's on his last legs, get home now. and before you get there, he's gone.
Ira, your podcast is presented by Bill Curry Ford. Bill Curry Ford, Tampa's first family of Ford, 0% APR for 72 months on new 2020 Fords. And as General Manager Sean Sullivan reminded us, 0% financing for 84 months on the remaining 2019 models. And that is not going to last. And these 0% offers won't last forever either. Bad credit, no problem. BillCurryFord.com. You can start shopping there. You can email Sean. You can stop in at the dealership. They are doing everything they can to accommodate people across the Tampa Bay area. They will bring the vehicle you want to test drive right out to your home, or you can deal right at the dealership. Fantastic service. They care at Bill Curry Ford. And these offers, Ira, 6 months deferred, no payments. It's incredible. Have you been enjoying the Ford Escape even more, your 2020 cherry red beautiful model?
You know, Steve, one aspect that I really haven't talked about on my vehicle is the rear space, you know, the back space. For example, I did hit the links last week. We won't talk about my score, played 9 holes. But, you know, your regular car space, you got to struggle to put the clubs in and wedge it in. And here, you know, I've said before, you do a little kick on the back of the vehicle and all of a sudden the rear door springs open. And I had trouble, Lee, with my lawnmower last week. It conked out. And I had to bring it over to the repair place. Now, normally, that's a nightmare, trying to get that into a regular sedan. And here, the door springs open, and I fit it in comfortably. So there's so many aspects of this vehicle from Bill Curry Ford that's exemplary. I could talk about it all day.
Ira, did you break 90 on the 9 holes?
You know what? They have an island hole. It's all of about 80 yards. And I teed it up high and used my lob wedge, Steve, and hit it within 4 feet of the cup. Missed the putt, Isbitz, you don't need to ask me. Missed the putt for a birdie, but managed to tap in for my par. And you know what? I was fairly encouraged because I took golf lessons last summer. I still remember some of the things, you know, slow down your backswing. And, Steve, I'm going to be out there again this week. You know, it's good for social distancing. It's just me and the turkeys and the geese out there. I'm going to try it again. How do you like that?
Let it be noted that you did not answer the question on whether you broke 90 with 9 holes, so we'll move on. Hopefully you enjoyed a fantastic Big Storm beer after your round of golf, Ira. The Wavemaker Amber Ale, which is the classic. Your favorite is, of course, the, what's that called again, Ira? The Tropic Pressure.
The Tropic Pressure. The Tropic Pressure.
Florida Ale.
Steve, I can't wait till Big Storm opens its doors, because the three of us might be ending up doing a podcast there. I think that's very feasible.
Absolutely, Ira. Yeah, they are starting like most of the rest of the world out there in our area with 25% capacity, and then they'll build up. Hopefully it'll be back to normal at the very least before the regular season, when you will be out at the Big Storm Odessa Tap Rooms and the Big Storm Clearwater flagship location, watching road games with Bucks fans. Big Storm beer, it really is all about the beer. It's available all across Florida. This is Florida's finest craft beer, brewed right there in Clearwater. Good people, good friends, fantastic beer. And you can find out where to buy it at BigStormBrewery.com or right at JoeBucksFan.com.
Steve, speaking about road games, a little something called the schedule might come out this week, Mr. Isbitz.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's schedule week as I open the podcast. So exciting, Ira. You know, Peter King, and there's been this rumor flowing around, and I didn't touch it. And then Peter King talked about sort of his feelings in a different realm, and it sort of tied together. King was writing on Monday morning that he would almost expect the Bucks to be on Monday Night Football to open the season. And as we know from past history, there are two games, and the first game, the 7 p.m. kickoff, is featuring East Coast teams, because they're not going to put a West Coast team on at 7 p.m. and vice versa. So that would be quite something if the Bucks opened at home on Monday Night Football against, say, Atlanta, which was the rumor.
Lee, what a change from years past. I would say since Gruden was dismissed following the 08 season. Lee, what a change. It's a byproduct of the Brady acquisition, now enhanced by Gronkowski. Every year at this time of year, a week before, a few days before the schedule was released, the three of us, Lee, for the past 4 years, would say the same thing. Well, what one primetime game are the Bucks going to get? That was the conversation, Lee, because for one reason, they had to be on prime time once by edict. That was the only reason. Otherwise, they'd be completely shunned on prime time. And now Lee, Peter King, reiterated it today that you and I have no reason to doubt it. We're looking at how, you know, four or five late primetime games. I mean, the Glazers got to be doing backflips about this.
I know I've said it on your podcast before, Ira, that it took a pandemic for this to happen, but there's no way the Glazers could have bought, much less anticipated, that the Bucks would dominate sports talk. Not football talk, sports talk for weeks on end. And that's all because of what star power does. And a lot of fans go nuts when they say, you say that. Oh, it's about the team. Yeah, right. It's about star power. It's about eyeballs. It's about entertainment. That's what it's about. You know, Tyler Johnson, the original Tyler Johnson, and I was a season ticket holder with the Lightning. It's nothing, you know, nothing to do with anti-Lightning in any way. I'm pro-Lightning. But Tyler Johnson could walk down Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and hardly anybody would say boo to him. They wouldn't know him. They wouldn't know him from a guy from Cleveland on vacation. Tom Brady doesn't get half a block down the road, and he'll be mobbed. That's what star power does.
Star power, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Steve. Star power.
It's like you in Publix, Ira, star power.
You know, Steve, this goes back a long way. I mean a long way. Remember, you know, the Jets had this guy, Sonny Werblin. Sonny Werblin.
That's a long way.
It's a long way, but he was the owner, you know, and now it's 65, and Namath's coming out of the draft out of Alabama. Star power, charismatic. Even back then, he hadn't played an NFL game. Star power. And they gave him, I think, a $400,000 contract in 65. People went crazy. They thought Werblin had lost his mind. Now, Werblin had a long history in show business. I think he was an agent, and he knew what sells, you know, on the big screen and entertainment. And people thought he was nuts. And all of a sudden, here comes Namath in 65, and, the Jets weren't a great team in 65. Yet all the talk was about Namath and, you know, taking Manhattan by storm and the ultimate bachelor. And, Steve, there's something to be said for star power, and it's being proven out again on the streets of Tampa.
Well, it's just going to be fun. I think it underscores, Ira, though, the fact that let's just play with the hypothetical. Let's say the Buccaneers open at home on Monday Night Football and they go on the road. You know, Tom Brady and the Bucs expect him to be a miracle worker. He's got to change that culture in a hurry, get these young guys not afraid of playing in a major primetime game on opening night, and then they got to turn around on a short week and hit the road. I mean, they cannot go 0-2 with the aspirations that they have, and it just sort of underlines the pressure out of the gate.
It does. And Lee, all the primetime games, you know, which the Patriots were used to, and Brady's used to it, and the Chiefs, Lee, it makes it a little more challenging. I mean, there's some short turnarounds. There's some challenges. You're out of your normal schedule. So, you know, there's a flip side to it also, Lee.
Is part of the flip side being a target?
I don't know. I think the Chiefs are a target more than the Bucks are a target because they haven't done anything yet. But people will take the Bucks more seriously. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I think Brady's a target for every defense. I mean, it's just going to jack you up. Every cornerback wants to go down in history and say, yeah, I picked off Tom Brady, and everybody wants to sack him. I think there's a little bit of that there. Ira, I wanted to ask you,
Justin Evans the last Bucs player to intercept Tom Brady?
Yep, Justin Evans at the Den of Depression, exactly. All right, Ira, speaking of star power, I don't know if you've been watching the Michael Jordan documentary, the 10-part series. Have you been watching, Ira?
Just a bit. I see that there's an obvious villain from what I can see is Jerry Krause, the general manager. Nobody's got anything good to say about this guy. Yet, in a way, guys, he put together that team. So, you know, you got to look at all sides of it.
Yeah, I don't think he's been portrayed as a villain. It's been actually pretty well balanced. I just figured I'd bring it up because on Sunday night's episode, Bette Midler made an appearance. So I figured you'd be very excited about that.
I was watching the 2020 debut of Billions. Billions. It's a story based on Joe Buck's fan, Billions. And it's a high-stakes drama fund manager. And his name's not Jeff Vinnick, but the guy's ruthless, unlike Vinnick. It's a battle of wills. So you're telling me to watch the Last Dance, and I'm telling you to watch Billions, gentlemen. And by the way, Homeland ended last week.
Thankfully.
And nobody died, Lee. No, you know, I thought Saul or or Claire Danes was going to get rubbed out. It didn't happen, Lee.
Yeah, I watched it. I had it on. I recorded it. I watched it, and I'm kind of thankful it's over. At one time, it was exceptional TV, and it really just dropped off the map. And I don't know why I was watching it, but they had me hooked, and it's over with, and I dropped Showtime next day.
That first season was spectacular. It was spectacular.
Oh, yeah. Very good. Very
good. Know, it was about a turncoat, you know, reminded me of Isbits a little bit, so some guy like a double agent. And, Steve, that's the way I look at you sometimes.
All right, Iris, second-year man, Devin White, Buccaneers defense. I'm going to read you a quote that he spoke recently in talking about the defense, and I want your reaction. Here it is. I'm going to read it with the bad grammar included. We was put in a lot of bad situations. You know, we never complained. We tried to make the best out of it. Like, so when we did get a lot of turnovers, our offense turned the ball over, and, you know, it overshadowed what we did a lot. Or teams were scoring on us, but they were starting so close in their own red zone already. I feel like we played our role on defense, and we didn't complain. And I think that was the main thing that we did.
Lee, I don't have a single problem with what he said, because I think it's true. They didn't bitch during the season. That showed professionalism. Despite 41 giveaways, Lee easily led the league. And besides all the points that they scored, you know, the seven pick sixes, Lee, it was all the points they set up with short fields. Now, Lee, I don't give the defense a pass. They did not play good winning football for 10 weeks, 10 games. But they showed marked improvement. I think that's a big, big reason the Arians look towards door number two is, hey, give this defense a break and make teams go 80 yards. They're not going to do it very often, but they can go 40 yards and kick a field goal or a touchdown. Lee, I don't see anything wrong with what he said.
No, I don't either. My observation, just talking to Devin White a few times, he's not a good poker player. He'll answer your questions, but if you talk or if you ask him about a subject that he doesn't want to talk about, his face turns into a quick frown, and he'll give you clipped answers. And the few times he was asked about Jameis or someone brought Jameis up, I got the distinct impression he was no fan of Jameis. And I am convinced, although I don't know this, it's just sheer speculation, I'm convinced that JPP and Sue told Arians, you know what, you bring Jameis back, I really don't have any interest in returning.
Wow.
That's just speculation. Now, I can't remember what game it was. It might have been Indianapolis. But there was a game, and I was taught this a long time ago, try to watch the bench, not so much as the game. Because the game, you can always watch replays. But the bench, you can't always watch the bench. You can't get replays of the bench. And I remember there was one pick that Jameis had. I don't remember the specifics. But what I do remember is, when that pick happened, that knucklehead that went to Oakland, massive, he looked like he wanted to punch somebody. He just shook his head back and forth like, you know, I remember he clenched one of his hands. He looked like he was wanting to strangle somebody, and he ripped his helmet up off the bench. He was hacked off. And, you know, everybody talks about Jameis being a leader and all this. There were some guys on offense that liked him and respected him, but I don't get the impression he was embraced by the entire team.
Steve, at some point, the sheer numbers, they batter you. They wear you down. And by that, I mean, all right, 41 giveaways. They're not all on Winston, but he's the guy under center. He's the guy touching the ball. 41 giveaways. Steve, that's 2.5 a game. So, you know, what do you get? You get 10 or 12 possessions, and you're giving away 2.5. You better have a hell of a defense to overcome that. They didn't have a hell of a defense. They had an improving defense as the season went on, but not a mature defense. Steve, they got battered by it. They couldn't keep up with it. Now, I've said it before, Steve, I think they had 28 takeaways. It was only 12 picks, but they did well with the fumbles, the forced fumbles and the fumble recoveries. So the total was 28. Steve, that's a respectable total. It's not a bad total. I think it's probably better than average. So on the takeaway scale, not bad, not bad. But they end up minus 13, and they're not good enough to overcome that, Steve.
Yeah, a couple of numbers for you, Ira. When I was writing this up, I dug out a few things. One, the Bucs obviously had the highest percentage of drives end in a turnover last year, number one in the league. but they were also number one in the league in 2018. They were third worst in 2017 and fourth worst in 2016 when they won nine games. They were very opportunistic with the turnovers in 2016. So it really underlines that, gosh, this team has been horrible for 4 years with turnovers. Everybody, I guess, was willing to be over it. But Devin White only played for the Bucks for one season. 4 years of turnovers. What is Levante David thinking? And JPP, like Lee mentioned, has been enduring this now for two seasons. You know, it does wear on guys.
It does beg the question, well, was Devin White speaking for a lot of other teammates at the time? You got to think
that. I'm sure he was. And Steve's talking about picks. I don't have them in front of me, but go look at the Jameis's picks, his splits, home and away.
Yes.
He was atrocious at home. Atrocious at home. And that is damning as can be. If you're that pathetic at home, how are you ever going to, you know, get out of the den of depression?
Yeah, Ira, the numbers I was given were turnovers. Obviously, a lot of them were picks, but a couple of years in there, he had big fumble issues. That wasn't necessarily
right.
The case last
right.
year. But Football Outsiders, which is the stat group that Lee and I lean much more in favor of, mostly because they always explain their logic, even if it's convoluted, they put it all out there, and they spend all this time developing these reports that are very highly detailed, and sometimes it takes them months to put it out. Anyway, they just put out their adjusted interceptions report, which basically does all the work on tipped balls that get picked, you know, basically bad luck for quarterbacks, and also balls that don't get picked that were sort of dropped by the other team. And interestingly, Tom Brady, last year, he had zero balls that were tipped and intercepted. Zero. Now, Jameis had two last year. Two of them. I think both were by O.J. Howard. And but that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, that happens to Jameis all the time. Well, he only had two. Baker Mayfield, Jimmy Garoppolo, Ryan Fitzpatrick, they all had three. So it wasn't like Jameis had some outrageous number. And Brady had seven balls last year that were what they claimed were dropped interceptions. And that was sort of middle of the pack. Jameis led the league with 13, and Carson Wentz, Dak Prescott with 10, Kyle Allen with 12, but Drew Brees had 6, and sort of middle of the pack is 6 or 7. So I don't know what that all means, Ira. Matt Ryan had 0 balls picked that were tipped. He only had 5 dropped interceptions, but Brady's looking for a very different standard here, and I think that, you know, somebody drops a ball and it gets tipped, or a tipped ball gets picked, he might freak out.
You know, Lee, I can't wait to see what kind of offense Arians, and to a lesser extent, Leftwich, to a lesser, I think it's still Arians. and I think you'd agree with me, Lee. Arians is the architect, and of course, with a lot of input from Brady, a lot, I can't wait to see what kind of offense they design around Brady. I mean, he's not the same kind of quarterback as Winston, and Lee, I'll be the first to say it quickly. Winston is better than Brady on some of these throws. He's better. That's a fact. You know, like that long seam pass or whatever. You know, Winston's exceptional on it. Now, that doesn't mean Winston's a better quarterback than Tom Brady. I'm not going there. Mm-hmm. But they're different, Lee. They're different. And because they're different, you don't come back with the same scheme. Lee, I'll go back to what I've said, you know, for the last month and a half. You don't hope for Brady behind door number two publicly, Lee, if you're not willing to be flexible and design your game plan around the man's strength. So things are going to change from an offensive standpoint.
I couldn't help but to think of the words of Michael Lombardi in your last comments there, Ira. When the word Lee Brady was coming to the Bucks, Mike Lombardi said, Leftwich will have no say with the offense. He will have no say, absolutely none.
You know, I think you'd have to say Leftwich's influence will be diminished, because Steve Winston was in no position to insist or suggest, you know, with any kind of great, you know, emphasis that was going to be taken seriously by the coaching staff, because he hadn't done anything, really. You know, he had one winning season. Here comes Brady. Steve, he's got 6 rings flashing and other Super Bowl appearances. And if he says I'm more comfortable doing X and X, I mean, Steve, let's be honest.
Yeah,
it's
a no-brainer, especially early in the season. What if he says he's comfortable with this and you're going to say no? Let's ease that in. I mean, you want to win. You got to go 3-1 here. You can't be rolling out to a 3-4 record and you know, they need instant impact, and they're going to go with what works, you know, and it speaks to the whole, you know, maybe opening on Monday Night Football thing. You know, at some point you got to just focus on winning the game. All right, Ira, I wanted to take you to a different direction here, but first remind everybody that, well, you know, we didn't even mention it yet. You spoke to Bruce Arians this week, and you'll touch on a couple of those points a little bit later. Ira, we want to remind everybody your podcast is presented by Bill Curry Ford, Tampa's first family of Ford, BillCurryFord.com. They're right on Dale Mabry Highway. They will take phenomenal care of you. Family service from our friend Sean Sullivan, the general manager. And Ira, the Buccaneers picked up a kicker last week. They picked up a kicker on waivers, Elliott Fry. He was with the Panthers, and they decided to move on. He was undrafted out of University of South Carolina. He's 25. He was with the Bears. He's with the Ravens. He played in preseason, but he has no regular season kicks. Are you excited? What does this all mean, Ira?
Lee, let me be very clear about this, Mr. DeKemper. On May 4th, 2020, if Elliott Fry is the only kicker that competes against Mr. Gay, whenever darn training camp opens, even if it's September or October, Buck fans will have every right to say, what the heck is going on over there at One Buck Place? Lee, you got to bring in some serious competition. You got to push Gay. Now, look, until the last game of the season, he had a decent rookie year. I mean, he blew the Giants game along with the defense. You're not supposed to lose a 21-3 halftime lead to a rookie quarterback. I'm not letting the defense off the hook, Lee. But the fact was he had a game-winning field goal, very makeable. He didn't get it done, Lee. He didn't get it done. But then he straightened out, and he was good until that last game, and there's no excuse for that last game. So, Lee, you got to do better than Elliott Fry. I'm sorry. Am I wrong here?
No, you're not wrong. And by the way, didn't Gay blow a kick against Houston? I don't know if that was the case or not. My memory is terrible.
Matt Gay missed 5 of his final 9 field goals with the Bucs last year.
Thank you, Steven.
He had as rotten of the last 2 games James had, so did Gay. Terrible.
Yes, yes.
And to your point, Ira, to emphasize your point, if whoever the Bucs kicker is and is lousy this year, Bucks fans have every right to scream at the 2 people running this organization. Why did you not bring in Gutkowski? Why? I don't know if the guy's still hurt. To the best of my knowledge, he's still available. He may still be hurt. But if that's the case, cover your rear ends and come out and say, we can't bring this guy in because he's got physical problems. Stay ahead of the game. Instead of letting all the crap fall on you, then you get mad at sports writers, text sports writers, about how we're always negative. How about you being ahead and treat people with honesty, the fans, your paying public? Like right now, in July, we can't bring in May, we can't bring the guy in because he's hurt. That's why we're looking at Hayden Fry or whatever the hell this guy's name is. you know, this is just nonsense. Is kicking the past decade has been garbage for kicking. They can't get it out of their own way, and I don't want to hear about the south end zone when dome kickers come in and kick better than anything the Bucks put on the field. This is ridiculous, and the Bucks have another rotten kicking game again this year. Whatever the hell those scouts are doing looking for kickers, you know, we all know they have a whatever the hell template they have in that organization for kickers, they didn't just throw it out in the window that across the street from Martin Luther King Drive where those damn alligators are in the pond. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. This is beyond logical.
Steve, may I suggest, Stephen, Mr. Brady would have no problem bringing in Gutkowski as competition for Gay. I don't think Brady would object. Do you?
No, of course not. It still might happen, but
if he's healthy, that's the kicker.
If he's healthy.
He was on injury reserve last year. And if that's the case, stay ahead of the game for your own sake. I mean, come out and say we're not bringing him in because he's unhealthy. Cover your rear ends. Don't, you know, 6 months from now when you had a rotten kicking game and we're writing about it, not just Joe Buck fan, but everybody else, then you're getting mad at people for writing about it. Hello? Hello?
You know, Steve, games are won and lost on the details, Steve. A bad penalty, a missed kick, you know, a blocked punt. Steve, the details matter. If it costs you a game or two, that's huge in a 16-game season.
I have no problem with Fry. I have no problem with anybody that they bring in because teams pick up kickers all the time, undrafted, in many different ways, and they work out just fine. I think it goes back to what Lee said. There's no faith or trust in the guys making the decision that they actually know how to find a good kicker, that they're, you know, they're just kind of spitballing it. So I don't care if it's Gostkowski or anybody else. The Bucks have Bucks have brought in many accomplished kickers here who have been horrible when they've arrived. And we've done it many, many times. So hopefully this guy is the guy, but I hope they bring in a third kicker in camp. I really, really do.
Me too.
Just pick a guy that's efficient. I don't care who he is. Just as long as he gets the job done. Well, is that too much to ask?
This Fry character was 14 of 14 in the AAF, so that's something, Ira. That's something. All right.
What did he kick for, Spurrier?
I don't know.
You know, one more quick point, guys. One more quick one. I'm on a special teams kick. I don't know why, because I've been looking at the Bucks and the Saints, and the Saints are the team to beat, and have been for 3 years in the division. And you know, Rick Goslin does annual special teams rankings every year, and they're very well respected. He does a deep dive into the kicking and the return games, and every year, guys, the Saints are in the top five. They're in the top five every year, and Bucks special teams haven't been very good. Lee mentions it all the time. They get no juice out of the return game, nothing. Punting have been okay. I mean, Pinion's good at touchbacks, but he's got to do a better job of punting. His net average wasn't very good, and of course, their annual kicking hijinks are well documented. So, Steve, that's an area where they don't match up with New Orleans right now. They got a long way to go there.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned New Orleans, Ira, and I agree with you. But one thing that where they match up with New Orleans, or excuse me, don't match up with New Orleans, is something you've been harping on, which is a backup quarterback. Now, we discussed this in the last podcast already, but Jameis had some more words to say in his little car wash of appearances. And I want you to try to make sense of this for me, because I'm just trying to understand Bucks history that's relevant to today and trying to make sense of it all. So this is Jameis on NFL Network. He was pushed to explain, well, okay, you had a relationship with Drew Brees and you were in touch with him during your career. What were you talking to him about? What were you trying to learn from him? Because Jameis said Brees was one of the few guys who would actually get back to you in the quarterback club when you reach out. Brees was always there for him. So this is Jameis says, well, I don't think I texted him as much as I should have. I asked him in terms of studying the run game versus the pass game. I'm not going to tell you his answer on that. But I also asked Brees in terms of, you know, how to get more accurate on throws to the left, about his footwork and about his base. Just quarterback nerdy stuff. I don't understand why Jameis is sort of reaching out to Drew Brees when he's got quarterback gurus with him for help to try to fix his game. Does that feel odd at all? I mean, I get it. Why not try? But does it seem odd to you at all?
Thinking the same way. Lee, I'm not trying to put Ryan Fitzpatrick in the same sentence as Drew Brees. I'm not. But, you know, Fitzpatrick has seen a few things over the years, Lee. He's been around. You know, he's not as prolific as Drew Brees in any measurement. But he's seen a few things. And to Steve's bigger point, Lee, you're surrounded by Tom Moore, Christensen, Leftwich, who played the position, and the quarterback whisperer. Do you need more voices in your head after that?
So when did he text Brees? 2 years ago? Last year? Two years ago? I don't know.
It's unclear. Jameis sort of phrased it as an ongoing thing. But still, I mean, he still had Cutter there to talk to. And even if we don't like Mike Bajakian as his quarterback coach, if Jameis didn't have faith in Bajakian and the way Bajakian was teaching him to be more accurate throwing to the left, then maybe that says even more than we need to know. All right. So Lee wrote something earlier this week about Albert Breer's discussion with John Lynch, who explained that the Bucks probably did have to trade up because the implication from Breer was that the 49ers were going to take Tristan Wirfs, or a very good chance there. Lee, if there's more you want to add there, or what did you think of that?
Yeah, just to fill people in, Lynch knew that Staley was going to retire, and Staley, the left tackle of the 49ers, longtime left back, and Staley agreed to keep it under wraps until the draft. The draft was over with. So the Lynch had reached out to Ron Rivera a couple weeks before the draft, and him and Rivera apparently have a very, very good rapport, and Lynch trusts Rivera. And Lynch told Rivera, you know, get back with me what you want about Trent Williams. If you're interested, we got to get this wrapped up before the draft. So I know what the target in the draft. We got to get it wrapped up. Well, Rivera's reply was interesting. Rivera got back with Lynch maybe a day or two before the draft, and he told Lynch, we're not going to get this wrapped up before the end of the, before the draft starts, because there's too many teams calling about Williams. Ding number one. Who's calling? So they go into the draft, and he's, you know, the lines of communication is still open with Rivera, but Lynch knows that there's other people involved. So he trusts Rivera, so he doesn't think Rivera is trying to drive up the price on him. So Wirfs falls to the 49ers. Lynch had his heart set on Javon Kinlaw, but he knew Staley was gone. He didn't know if he was going to have Williams, but he knew he was in the ballpark with Williams, but it wasn't for sure, and he's like, you know, I got a pretty good defensive line as it is. Right now I have no left tackle. Should I go left tackle and sign Wirfs and take my chances with defensive line? And then Light calls. And Light said, what do you want for this pick? Light was paranoid someone was going to jump ahead of him and get Wirfs. Maybe Light knew, maybe he didn't know it. That team in particular was the 49ers. And Lynch thought to himself, he goes, what are you offering? Light says, fourth-round pick and my first round. And Lynch thought to himself, you know what? That fourth-round pick will be just enough ammo to get if I have to. That will give me enough ammo to get Williams. And so he said, okay, let's do it.
I'm not buying it. I'm not buying the Breer report. I'll give you two reasons why. One, if I got my eyes on a left tackle and I'm desperate and I don't think I can get Trent Williams, or I'm not very sure I can get Trent Williams, and I really believe in Wirfs as a left tackle on a championship team, a fourth-round pick is not going to sway me. I'm taking Wirfs. I don't think that was the case. Number one, and this has been suggested, gentlemen, and I'm not knocking Wirfs as a pick for the Bucks at 13 as a right tackle, but it has been suggested he does struggle at this point with some speed rushers. Now, I think that can be minimized a bit as a right tackle, better than you can do it as a left tackle, and I don't think Lynch had full faith in Wirfs as a rookie left tackle on a championship 49er ball club. That's number one. Number two, I believe that in the discussions with Rivera, Lynch became convinced that one way or another, he would end up with Trent Williams. He wasn't sure what the cost would be. He might think there's other suitors, but he was going to do whatever it took to get Trent Williams as his left tackle. Otherwise, he stays at 13, Steve, and he drafts Wirfs. I'm not buying the Breer report.
I'm just skeptical of why John Lynch would be honest with Albert Breer about his draft strategy, and, you know, because guys can sort of look at that the next year and maybe look for trends. I don't know. It's hard to tell. But, yeah, it sounds to me, and it was pretty much stated there, that you know, they believed they could get Williams, and they were willing to gamble on it. But, you know, I think Lynch maybe painted that a little more than he thought. He knew he could get the deal done for whatever reason.
And, Lee, you know, Wirfs' draft profile, the road grader, it just extrapolates, I think, a lot better, at least at the start, to putting him at right tackle. And I think he'll do a good job for the Bucks at right tackle, especially in opening up some holes for the running game. But Lee, to start Wirfs at left tackle on a team that reached the Super Bowl, I don't think Lynch was willing to go there, Lee.
Any rookie, for that matter. I tend to agree with that. I also think the fourth-round pick, you know, Lynch is, if you believe him, and apparently you guys don't, if you believe him, that fourth-round pick, he thought, okay, I can use this as ammo. that I could lock up the deal with Williams.
I think he wanted Kinlaw at 13, and he got Kinlaw at 14. I think that's what happened.
Yeah, that's just me. I primarily don't believe any of these GMs. I mean, it's in their job description to lie and misdirect. You know, why not do it after the draft? You would think the smart ones would do it after the draft just to set up and keep their guys off balance. I'm not calling him just a compulsive liar, but, you know, who knows? All right, Ira. Now, look, we need to hear from you on something that is important. And obviously, closer to your heart than I realized, Ira. You wrote a powerful column the other day saying that you're going to be talking to the Hall of Fame about changing some of the bylaws to accommodate assistant coaches and your push for Monty Kiffin to be elected to the Hall of Fame and be the first assistant coach put in there who was purely an assistant coach. Maybe you could explain what needs to change at the Hall and what you're going to do about it.
Yeah, I brought this topic up with the other selectors, you know, those 45 other selectors, and it goes nowhere. And I've brought it up with some of the officials at the Hall. There's really no mechanism so far to get an assistant, any assistant coach in. There's a head coach category. There's contributors. There's players. The coach category, it seems like it's, assumed that it's head coaches only. Nobody's ever been talked about as an assistant. Now, look, you could argue whether if there was an assistant category, Kiffin would be the first guy. It's a fair argument. I mean, there's other guys. There's Arnsbargers and Bud Carsons and Jim Hannifins. Yeah, I mean, you could make strong arguments for a lot of these guys.
I was thinking Jim Hannifin, too, and just off the top of my head, who was the offensive line coach forever with the 49ers?
McKittrick.
McKittrick. Gruden loved that guy.
Yeah, he did. Gruden loved that guy. There's no question about it. He passed away, I think, from cancer. It really hit Gruden hard. But, Lee, there's no mechanism for honoring assistant coaches. They've been a big part of the National Football League for 100 years. If you have a great, you know, Wade Phillips, Lee, I mean, a so-so head coach and an exceptional assistant. Dick LeBeau is a player. He's in.
Yeah, but he can also go in as assistant coach. He was good.
So
Tom Moore,
another good one, Lee. So maybe you could do contributors / assistant coaches, whatever way you want to do it. I don't think they'll put in a separate category for assistant coaches. I don't see that. Maybe you open up the coaches category to assistant coaches. I mean, there's not a credible 20-man backlog for head coaches. There's not. I mean, you know, there might be four or five guys that are close, the Holmgrens. Some people like Tom Flores. You know, I understand that. Some people like Schottenheimer, Dan Reeves. But it's not 20 guys long like there is with the old-time senior players. It's not. So if you could include assistant coaches under the coach category, I just want to, you know, open the door a little bit, Lee. And I think Kiffin, you know, during his incredible 13-year run in Tampa, I think he's a very credible candidate in terms of assistance, Lee.
Pardon me if I'm mixing things up here, Ira, but would you be kosher with, and I can't remember the award, I'm sorry, but each year they honor someone, a longtime media member, and they get a plaque, and there's a plaque in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Something similar to that, like a assistant coach plaque, whatever, name it after somebody, you know, and they may have Bud Carson, whomever, Arnsberger, and every year an assistant coach of the past is honored.
No, that's not good enough for me, Lee. It's not good enough. I want the Buston Canton. That's the McCann Award you're thinking about.
Yes, McCann Award, yeah.
That, you know, the Peter Kings and Dan Pompeys and Rick Goslins and Ira Millers and Vito Stellino. They all won it. No, Steve, I'm talking about a bust, the same kind of bust that the Don Shulas of the world have been honored with, and the Dungies and the Bill Walshes. Because I think you could argue and the right assistant coach can make all the difference. And right now, not a one is in Canton, and I think that's a shame.
Well, well said, Ira. And as far as that McCann Award, you got to step up and participate and let us pitch you for it, Ira. You're, according to the bylaws of the Hall of Fame, that McCann Award is primarily based on longevity of covering the league and you're up there among the all-timers.
I've only been doing it for 40 years, Steve. I guess they got to wait till it's 50 years.
Shereen Williams is in, Ira. Come on.
Anyway. No comment, gentlemen. No comment.
All right, Sage. You spoke to Bruce Arians, and you spoke to him for your column at JoeBucksFan.com that people can read there. But you also talked to him a little bit about the current Bucks. What can you share when a Sage picks up the phone, calls Arians, and he says, "Hey, Ira, I'm sitting here in Georgia. How are you, buddy? What can you share?"
Well, the first thing I can share is he's playing 18 holes later this week, and he can't wait for it. He just can't wait. He's up by the lake house, he has no idea what's going on with the off season. He doesn't know when he's going to be able to do anything but virtual coaching. He's getting a little frustrated about it. But we talked a little bit about the defense of the 2020 Bucks. I joked with him, and I was only half joking. And I said, "Bruce, you ought to go out and get a couple of lottery tickets because you've gotten everything you've asked for in this offseason." He didn't disagree. He laughed. I think he said, "You're right, Ira." And, I mean, let's be honest. Lee, he asked for Brady behind door number two. He asked for the front seven on defense to return. I guess he's not crying about Carl Nassib at this point, Lee, because he got the guys he wanted. And then, he gets Gronkowski as a bonus, Lee. I mean, what a run he's had. But we talked a little bit about the defense, and, he mentioned something, guys, I'll get into it more in the column. He did mention, when I talked about his confidence in the defense of the 2020 Bucks. And he focused on the secondary and the strides they made late in the 2019 season. But he also mentioned, Lee, the burden that that the defense was under for much of last season in terms of the giveaways and how they were put in very, very difficult positions. And obviously the suggestion is going to be that instead of 41 giveaways, they're going to have 20 giveaways. And if people think that's a low number, the Saints just had eight, gentlemen, eight. I mean, that's remarkable. And it's with a starting quarterback missing 5 weeks. They still had eight giveaways. I mean, that's an all-time record. I don't think that's reasonable to expect for the Bucks this year. But what about cutting down to 41 in half, Lee? That will have a marked impact on your defensive numbers, Lee, in terms of short fields, the seven pick sixes. So, Lee, that is a big part of the confidence that Arians has in this defense going forward, is that they're not going to be put in bad positions. And that comes from the head coach, Lee.
Very telling, especially his words in his actions.
And it's probably a big reason, Steve, that he was looking behind a door number two rather than bring Winston back.
What do you make James's chat on NFL Network and with Colleen Wolf, and that is very important to make that a point. He was interviewed by Colleen Wolf. James said, I can't believe he actually said this. James said that Tom Brady will be definitely pushed by Blaine Gabbert and Ryan Griffin. My response to that is, the only thing those guys are going to push at Tom Brady is his lawnmower.
Sometimes I wonder about Winston. I'm surprised he didn't use the word amazing before he said Blaine Gabbert. That's one of his favorite. I worry about Winston. He might be working out too much, Steve. He might have to start eating some gumbo to get his equilibrium, because that's an absurd statement on its face. Steve, I don't know what he was trying to suggest there. I don't know if that's a knock at Brady or trying to build up Griffin and Gabbert. But he picked the wrong guy to say it to, Steve, in terms of me, because I'm the guy bitching that the Bucks don't have enough behind Brady as a backup quarterback. Never mind guys that are going to push him. I want somebody better. So I just don't get it, Steve. Once in a while, he comes up with something that you scratch your head.
Well, I didn't even mention earlier that in one of his interviews, actually it was with the Saints media, he said that he used to have to get information and coaching tips by searching Google. Now he can get it in his quarterback's room.
I'm surprised he didn't say he'd read Joe Bucks Fan to try to get some tips. That would make more sense.
Monday we hear about the winningest coach in NFL history has passed away at the age of 90. What a life, Don Shula. What a career.
A somber time for a lot of old-time Bucks fans, because before there were the Buccaneers, the Dolphins were the number one team in Tampa. I remember a guy you used to work with at the Tribune, Bill Ward, in the sports department, telling me about how he used to climb up onto his roof in his old house growing up locally in the very early 70s, adjusting his television antenna with his parents so he could make sure to get those Dolphins games in the early 70s, because that's all there was. And there are tons of old Bucks, old Dolphins fans in the Tampa Bay area. And, you know, so this is a tough time for them.
Steve, it's funny you mention that, because besides Bill Ward, you know who's also a former Dolphin fan? The Glazers. The Glazers.
Well, they're from that area, right?
And they watched the Dolphins in the Orange Bowl, went to many a Dolphin game under Shula. And by the way, Shula got there in 1970. Miami was 3-10-1 the year before. They wanted Shula so badly and pry him out of Baltimore under contract that they gave up a first-round pick for Shula. So Gruden wasn't the only guy that was ever traded for a first-round pick. Shula was traded for a first-round pick. They go there, and from 3-10-1, they win 10 games. I mean, you talk about a one-year turnaround, no adjustment period, no nothing. And, boy, it was fast. The next year, they upset my Chiefs. Longest game ever played still. You know, all these years, 50 years later, it's still the longest game ever played, that overtime playoff loss by KC. And they got ripped by Dallas in the Super Bowl, but that was a tremendous Cowboys team in 71. Tremendous team. But it set the stage for Miami's success. And, Steve, the Glazers grew up Dolphin fans. And, of course, the Bucks didn't come around until 76. They saw a lot of winning football in Miami, Steve.
I got you. One thing that I think is a big piece of Shula's legacy and just a tremendous piece of NFL history is his heavy hand in drafting Dan Marino number 27 overall. And there were so many quarterbacks taken before, so many teams that passed on Marino. And, you know, that set the stage for that incredible run.
I'm writing a column about him. You know, the more I think about it, and this sounds a little crazy, Lee, you tell me what you think, but I think he might be a little bit underrated. I think he could be a little bit underrated because you hear Lombardi, Paul Brown, Bill Walsh. Some guys, you know, they're all put ahead of him on some of these lists. And, Lee, it's all about the wins. The only guy, you know, with a perfect season, and he might be a little bit underrated, Lee.
I agree with you. You always hear about Tyson Lombardi, Noel, Walsh, Landry, guys like that. I'm sure I'm missing someone else in there I'm missing out on.
Paul Brown. Yep.
Paul Brown's a little bit underrated, although a lot of people give him props. Hallis, you don't hear much about Hallis. And who knows if all his wins were just the fact that he owned the team and he was coach for, what, 60 years or something like that. But, yeah, you don't hear a whole lot about Shula, and that's the only guy with undefeated season. And I'm not really sure why he's not there with the rest of those guys. The only thing I could think of is a lot of people, and Ira, tell me if I'm wrong or not, this is just my perception, that they thought the Dolphins underwhelmed many years with Marino, that he was cronyism had crept in with Shula. He was sort of like what Dirk – I hate to compare the two, but – like Dirk Cutter had his buddy Mike Smith as defensive coordinator. Shula had his buddy Tom Offaldotti as defensive coordinator forever. He was basically the Mike Smith of his day. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seemed like the luster wore off, even though to me Shula proved what a very good coach does. He takes the talent he has available and molds an offense or defense around them. You know, for example, with Greasy, that was a 3 yards in a cloud of dust kind of team. They didn't rely on the pass at all. They could pass it, but they relied on the run because he had those horses in the backfield.
Right.
But Marino was like pass, and he had a lot of success. It was just two completely different concepts of football, and he did well with both. That, to me, is an excellent coach.
Steve, that's not a bad point by DeKemper. Matter of fact, for his first good point in about 3 weeks, but a good point, a good point nevertheless, Steven. Marino, a first ballot Hall of Famer, if there ever is one,
got into the Super Bowl in his second season. Now, look, no shame losing to the 84 49ers. That's, in my book, that's one of the three or four best teams of all time. Yeah, and that was before Jerry Rice got there. That was a fantastic team. They lost only one game, I believe, during the regular season, and ripped Miami pretty good in that Super Bowl. But Marino never got back, and so neither did Shula. They made the playoffs every year, Steve, but I'm sure when that 1984 season ended, Marino had to figure he's going to be back 3, 4, 5 times, Steve. It never happened, and it just shows you, once you get there, you better cash in. Shula had some of the most crushing defeats ever, of course, led by the Namath Jets upsetting the Colts, 18-point yeah. underdogs. Steve, I mean, that's brutal. Bounces back. Steve, now, Shula has some Tampa connections, Steve, because I believe Shula's Steakhouse, which is on West Shore Boulevard, I believe that's the second steakhouse that he had. The first one was Miami Lakes. The second one was Tampa. I think the third one was Orlando. And, Steve, on a personal note, I went to Shula's Steakhouse when it opened because they invited a representative from the Tribune, and they sent me over there, and I had lunch with Shula. You know, the lunch was impeccable. The price was right, Isbeth, of course. And I remember sitting there that day, it was about 25 years ago, and I always had this thing in my mind about the 72 Dolphins and the 73 Dolphins. And by the way, they almost made it a three-peat. They had that crazy catch against Oakland. Otherwise, Miami would have been in another Super Bowl. To see your hands, the 74 season. Steve, I had the audacity to suggest to Shula, Don, I know the 72's team, nobody's ever done it before or since and gone undefeated, but I think the 73 team was better. What do you think of that, Coach? And he looked at me, and he knew what I was talking about because they breezed through the postseason.
Sure.
And the 72 Dolphins did not breeze through the postseason. In fact, I think they had to rally in the fourth quarter in one of the games. And by the way, gentlemen, this is one of the all-timers. The Dolphins were undefeated, and I believe in the second playoff game, they went on the road. They went on the road. I think they went to Pittsburgh. I mean, that's nuts. You can't do that.
Speaking of Pittsburgh, wasn't that the 74 Steelers? Like, the See a Hands game was an AFC semifinal. They called it the AFC Championship, even though Pittsburgh was playing someone else, and then Pittsburgh went to Oakland the following week and beat Oakland.
I do believe you are right. The Raiders beat the Dolphins that day in Oakland. And I believe they lost to the Steelers, and the Steelers ended up winning the Super Bowl, I think probably against Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And I think the Dolphins would have beat Minnesota as well.
Yeah.
So that could have been a three-peat. But Shula he had so much pride about the 72 team. I mean, justified pride, that he would harbor no thoughts that the 73 team was better. I thought it was, particularly on offense. But it was a very enjoyable afternoon with Shula. And you knew, Steve, you know when you're in the presence of greatness. And that's how I felt that day.
What'd you eat, Ira? What'd you order?
I believe it was crab cakes in a steak restaurant. That's just me, baby.
Classic Sage. Yeah,
coming,
you know,
from the guy who ordered a salad at Primanti's.
I always go against the grain, this bitch. Always.
And you know,
I got a question for you. It's Tampa Bay area football history and the Dolphins. I could swear I saw a documentary about the Dolphins, you know, the perfect season, of course, and Shula coming to Miami. I could have sworn in this documentary they said the Dolphins training camp in Shula's first season was in St. Petersburg.
Wow. Wow.
Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I remember the documentary. It sure looked like Admiral Farragut. Now, granted, this was like 1970,
1969. 1970, he got to Miami. I got to go check that out. Now, Steve, you know, Steve, that rubs me raw because that 83 draft, Lee, that was the year of the quarterback, the prospects. Six or seven of them went in the first round. And my Chiefs were sitting there at number seven, Lee. They had no quarterback. And guess who they take at number seven?
Todd
freaking Blackledge from Penn State. A bust among all busts. And, I mean, they don't even draft Tony Eason. As bad as he was, he got to the Super Bowl.
with the Patriots. Todd Blackledge, that's an all-time bad first-round pick, especially in a year, Lee, that Marino lasts till the end of the first round. Incredible.
The documentary I saw that NFL Network's played over and over before, it's fantastic. It's about that draft, and the entire documentary is based off of
Marvin Demoff.
Yeah, so Marvin, this whole documentary is based off of Marvin Demoff's meticulous notes about the draft that year. And it's fantastic. But they're interviewing Shula about that. And Shula said when the Steelers passed on Marino, Shula thought for sure that University of Pittsburgh was hiding something. He goes, the Steelers are in their backyard. They know everything about the guy. So Shula talked about, he immediately picked up the phone, called Foj Fazio, who was the head coach of Pittsburgh. He's like, level with me. What's wrong with him? What do you have on him? And Fazio's like, nothing. I've got nothing. And apparently Shula said there was something on Marino, and it was in Shula's safe, and he was never to release it.
Oh.
So, I gotta ask you this, and I know you'll like this because you like to talk about the halcyon days of sports writing. When sports writers were actually powerful people in the community, was not Ed Pope the famous sports writer and sports columnist at Miami Herald? Was he like a liaison or a go-between with Shula and Joe Robbie to get Shula down to Miami from Baltimore?
I think that's true. Just like Tom McEwen was so involved in all the big things that happened on the Tampa sports scene. Now, Steve, here's the part of the 83 draft that Buck fans are not going to want to hear about, Steve. Steve, that was the year the Bucks traded for Jack Thompson. They didn't even have a pick. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that, Steve.
Well, you know, also the whole Marino draft is a big piece of Raider history because I believe the Raiders had the pick directly before the Dolphins. And it sort of ties to the Bucks because the Raiders were going into that season. Now, they won the Super Bowl in 83, but they were going into that season with a 36-year-old quarterback named Jim Plunkett, who basically faded after that season. And so the Bucks had their chance this year to draft a quarterback with a 43-year-old QB, but they passed. And, if the Raiders didn't pass on Marino, they would have had Marino and continued their reign most likely.
No question about it. You know, they talk about a Mount Rushmore, Steve, of coaches. You put Don Shula on there and you move on.
Ira, I don't know if you took part in one of these things, but I'm reading this from Bernie Miklos. We both know Bernie Miklos well. He's like the dean of NFL sports writers and columnists in St. Louis. Yes, I get that they don't have an NFL team anymore, but he's been covering the NFL not only to see St. Louis lose two teams, he was covering the Baltimore Colts when they lost a team. So he's been an NFL guy and has seen three franchises leave the city. So if he happens to decide to move to another city, you better hope there's no franchise there. You know, the guy's bad luck. Anyway, Bernie wrote this about, and he covered the Colts in Baltimore right out of college. And anyway, this is one of his Twitters. As a young sports writer, I'll never forget my first trip to Miami to cover Don Shula's Dolphins. After post-game Q&A, scribes were invited to a hospitality area to hang with Shula. Cold beer was offered. A congenial Shula socialized. A different time and place.
Boy. You know what that takes me back to, and I hate to put these two guys in the same sentence. It's kind of absurd, but, you know, after his first couple of years in Tampa, Ray Perkins, gentlemen, had a stir fry at his backyard. I'm not kidding. He was getting such bad press those first two seasons, and the Bucks stunk, and I guess the PR department talked some sense into him. You know, Perkins invited the local media to his house, and we went in the backyard and had a little stir fry with Mr. Perkins. I hate to put those two guys in the same sentence, Steve, but so be it.
Next thing you know, Ira, you'll be swimming in Jason Light's pool. All right, Ira, I'm going to send you out of here. You are going to give your closing address to the good fans of Tampa Bay. And, of course, everybody drink Big Storm beer responsibly, bigstormbrewery.com. And do not wait when it comes to Bill Curry Ford. Get to BillCurryFord.com. Don't forget their used selection as well, biggest in the area, and their nationwide lifetime warranty on new and pre-owned vehicles. And you don't have to comment on this, Ira. We can see if it lasts and talk about it next podcast. and give your final address to the fans now. But I wanted to mention to you, DraftKings Sportsbook, they operate in 6 states, including New Jersey, and they take a ton of action right now. As we record this podcast, the Buccaneers are favorites to win the NFC South ahead of the Saints. All right, Ira, say goodbye to the good folks.
I'll end this podcast on this note. The schedule's coming out later this week. That's a very personal subject for me, and I'll tell you why, Lee, because some of those primetime games, and there might be 4, 5, 6 of them involving your Tampa Bay Bucks, and some of them will be on the road. So there will be night games on the road, and what does that mean for me personally? Because it's all about me, DeKemper. We know that. That means that instead of strolling into Big Storm at 12:15 on a Sunday afternoon, I'm showing up, you know, at 7:30 on a Monday night or a Thursday night or a Sunday night. That means the drinking and the camaraderie will happen under the stars instead of under the sunlight. And it also means that I'll be driving home in pitch darkness, Big Storm, brewery, you know, nighttime driving. Lee, I got to be careful this year. Got to be careful.
Ira, there's this thing in the 21st century called Uber.
You love that Uber. You absolutely love that Uber.
It's worth it.